My name is Peter Townsend, and after teaching at Ayrton in my youth, I came back to the school only 10 years ago at the invitation of Tony Giddens, who struck a blow against ageism, and I've been very grateful for the opportunity to continue teaching in these years. I've had, secondly, some acquaintance with the theme of today's seminar on inequalities in health. And it's worth saying that some of the same ingredients of strategy still need to be discussed intensively. I know that you've been mentioning the Marmot Commission this morning. I would only want to call your attention to one particular strand of that report, the one which speaks of social protection across the life course. I, like many others in different strands, acknowledge that in reaching a consensus in issuing a report, some things that are very important are not properly acknowledged and supported. And that is true of any of the major international reports that you or I may be considering. But in this case, I think it continues several decades to escape sufficient attention and prominence that in achieving greater equity in health, one striking gap is often left. And that is the development of universal social security systems in all countries. Currently, there's an increasing debate about the importance of social security in the developing countries. And I've been involved in an ILO enterprise which is being published in a few weeks' time, about the new role that social security can and should play, not only in developing countries, but also in the rich industrialized countries. That happily pushes to new prominence the old fact that I learned back in the late 1970s in helping to write the Black Report in England on inequalities in health, that the priorities that we selected, the team that wrote the report, was the issue of child development as the priority, including the development of family and child allowances in order to make an immediate contribution to the better health and survival of a large section of children in the population. So maybe you haven't had somebody making a thrust on that score, and I felt as chair you would allow me to spend a couple of minutes just talking about it. And I'd be happy to come back in any opportunity we have for discussion later. But we have four people speaking this afternoon. And the first on your list and on mine is Dr. Peter Makara from Hungary, and who we had a number of acquaintances is a particular acquaintance, Scrooge Affairs in Hungary, who I also acknowledge as pretty important in terms of both social protection and equity and health.
Chairman, before starting my presentation, just three remarks. First, when I started my professional career in the late 60s, you were already a living legend, and I'm deeply privileged to be chaired today by you, and I hope my presentation will be in the spirit of your recommendation. The second remark is on my position missing here, because I'm on move. You know, at times it's really needed. I'm a former head of the National Agency for Health Promotion in Hungary, was a former WHO officer, but from September I will be the head of health policy at the Faculty of Health Sciences at the University of Debrecen. So, civil service finished, and university life starts. And the third issue, and this is the most important, I would like to make some general remarks in a debate provocated a little bit by Martin McKee. And I would like to make my position very transparent. Not universal, just transparent. First, I think there is more than one type of style. I can recommend you Karl Mannheim, a Hungarian origin author on the sociology of sciences, who describes in a classical way the different relationships between policymaking and scientific activities. Anyways, science, policymaking is a meta-scientific activity, not that ethno-scientific activity. I would never like to live in a world programmed by hybrid epidemiologists working instead of policymakers in decision-making systems. I don't think it's a nice dream. I have lots of suspicion about the concept of evidence-based policymaking. Policymaking should be based on the best available knowledge. From different perspectives. Epidemiology might be one of the key elements of priority setting in policy making. But policy making is about power, is about process, and a good policy making for tackling social and economic determinants for health inequities is at first a value-driven activity, not a scientific, a value-driven activity. So, having said that, in my presentation today, no one empirical data I can promise you, but also no dreams for changing the world, something in the middle. We have in my country some experts. And I would like to focus in this 15 minutes, what I have to say, on tackling this crisis situation and economic depression from health inequity perspective in Hungary. We have in Central and Eastern Europe, and Martin Dobatos better than me, all the epidemiological data of this period. We had a transformational crisis in the early 90s in Central and Eastern Europe, with a very significant drop in gross national product. In Hungary it was about 40% at that time in 5 years. That means a much tougher recession than who knows what we can expect right now, with rising high unemployment rate, very high inflation, which is not the case now, rapidly increasing inequalities, but in a quite different international setting, with a very friendly setting, growing worldwide economy, international support and so on. I don't want to stand here. What we have as present challenge, we can already feel the first small signs of empirical evidence for instance, at the level of family aggression, at the level of alcoholism and so on, we have the first sign of the discretionary impact of the crisis relates to the increasing inequities in health. But this is without any epidemiology, without any sociology. This is something we know. There is an inequal impact of the crisis on the different strains of the society, and the first victims of the crisis are and will be socially excluded people, poverty, migrants, unemployed, hopeless, Roma in the case of Hungary, and that kind of thing. There are two very clear direct impacts of the crisis. The first are the labor market changes. Unemployment, and who are the losers of unemployment? We know a lot, and we have lots of empirical evidence on the impact on health of different types of unemployment at short and longer term in different life cycles. But also, and this is something has not to be neglected, the issues of job insecurity, general uncertainty feelings in the society and health. I think one of the key dimensions of inequities in health and the increasing problems are the issues related to the mental health of the population, and namely in socially excluded types of population. Losing social status, one of the most dangerous social position at the present Hungarian society is the lower middle class shifting towards poverty, losing the downward social mobility, losing the social position, even in a worse mental situation than genuinely poor people. Depression. We have strong empirical evidence, and Martin could confirm it, on the ascending role of depression, explaining a large part of middle-aged men mortality, ascending middle-aged men mortality in Hungary, and the phenomenon relates to depression and the other different epidemiological indicators related to increasing depression. We can certainly expect to rise even in the second half of this year. Third issue is the impact of deteriorating living standards and the socially selective impact of deteriorating living standards on family consumption, on food consumption, on smoking habits, and so on and so on. The first impact we can already prove a statistical way. The elasticity of food consumption is lower in lower social strates, so already the weight of fat consumption, pork fat consumption, which is the traditional unhealthy food in Hungary, is already increased in the last half a year after a changing tendency in the last decade. That's the result clearly of the crisis in food. Also, the share of food expenses in the family budget will increase once again. And this is also a socially differential selective phenomenon. Also, we have to focus now our short-term programs and short-term policy measures on the most vulnerable groups of the society, namely the Roma. I don't want to re-enter this issue, who is Roma in Hungary and why, and all the ethical and legal issues related to it. On the basis of sound empirical estimates, there is more than 12 years of difference in life expectancy between Hungarian Romas and other Hungarian citizens. And they will suffer this crisis. Also, population in fragile areas. We didn't discuss the issue of geographical aspects of inequalities. In some geographical areas near to the Ukrainian border of Hungary, where there is no labor market practically, only only socially excluded people living in these marginal areas. Life expectancies at birth in the last year were worse than in the 1920s. That means 90 years ago, and still declining. Well, in Hungary, generally speaking, life expectancy is improving. But in these areas, it's still declining as compared to the level of 90 years ago. Unbelievable. I'm sure there is no one other social indicator of Hungary, public life, similarly to it. What are the policy-making dilemmas we have to face at short term? First, public health depends totally, nearly totally, on public expenditure. And when we have to face budgetary cuts, who are the first victim? We, on the periphery of the political over the decision-making system, with very poor, very weak advocating power. So, then, if with very nice pink color WHO recommendations to doing this and that are tailored and made for growing economies, to redistribute in a more healthy way a surplus of the budget. But now what we can redistribute is the deficit, not the surplus. And so there are, it's very nice to speak about health in all policies. But when you have to redistribute the deficit, and there is no discretionary part in the budget to opt to healthy options, what can we do? What type of political tactic to choose in this situation? Well, it's clear that short-term crisis management marginalizes long-term values, like equity, like universality, like solidarity. Let's have a try to negotiate with the Hungarian policy maker replanning the budget of this year, and speaking about solidarity is hard. And also in the noise we have in mass communications, health advocacy does not reach public attention. We have practically no voice, or very limited voice, in this bargaining process. However, budgetary deficit is not an excuse for moral deficit in policy making, and crisis is not for that. What can we do in this situation? Not just to give up. Certainly not. We have to think in European terms, and in national and in regional and local terms. How we can deal with the impact of the recession on that? The first is to think about the impact on the labor market. The labor market is a crucial field of struggle from health and health equity perspective. The recommendation on active inclusion and anti-discrimination legislations are of the Council of Europe and of the EU are more relevant than ever. And we have to learn to defend them. What is needed to propose at European level is to invest in a core set of services to create sustainable and decent health-promoting or health-supporting jobs. Also, in this crisis situation, it's time to think about guaranteeing access to core health and public health services throughout Europe, and to promote essential public health functions to each EU citizen. And also it would be nice at European level to recognize and support the role of public health services and NGOs as forefront actors in crisis times. That's why I think the European Commission and Member States should monitor budgetary and tax cuts to ensure that it is not detrimental to solidarity objectives and to equity in health. Also, the European Commission and Member States should consider investments in public health infrastructure and as anti-cyclic, anti-crisis type investments, and as investment and not a ghost in national budget and accountability system, which is supervised by the Commission. I like the high-level expert group on EU financial supervision. The European Commission should set up an expert group to monitor and make proposals on the social and health impacts of the financial crisis. And particular attention in the structural funds, and that's hopefully the case of my country, there is a very important investment for public health in the structural funds, but at European level, a particular attention in using the structural fund must be dedicated to public health and equity-related public health issues. Which are the equity-focused policy options we have in the field of health? And I don't speak about revolutionary changes in the world. I'm too old for it. But there is certainly one issue related to also this seminar, is better reflecting socioeconomic inequalities of health. That is about information data research. Martin made an excellent presentation. We have to utilize better the work of the WHO Commission, or the Marmot Commission on Social and Economic, and to translate it to the political language of Central and Eastern Europe and also to the EU language. Because, frankly speaking, the report is more developing country-oriented in policy recommendations and also sometimes seems to be too naive for our political system. The political proposal side is not the best side. As it happens often, we are very strong in situation analysis, in describing the realities, and much less in analyzing our policies. However, in brackets, not just epidemiology, policy analysis is also a science. Maybe a less hard science, but it's also using other methods, other bases. Then, we have to take more gender differentials into account, including men's health. Middle-aged men losing job, facing economic crises, might be also among the first victims in this crisis. What we need very much is tailor-made solutions, policies for different vulnerable groups. And this is a pitfall story of the last 2 decades. More we fight inequalities, more inequalities are increasing. More we create Roma decay programs, worse the situation of the Roma is decaying. And the Lisbon principles and fighting against poverty is also certainly a pitfall throughout Europe. And also in my country, despite some complex results, but basically it's certainly not a success story. And we know very well, if we focus on small Roma communities, we will not increase equity in health at global level. However, these tailor-made policies, focusing maybe on very small issues of different socially excluded and deprived groups, just increasing their social support, just a few small solutions in the case of child poverty or whatever. These are maybe the best progresses, even if we can't make the big overall picture of inequalities in health. Then there is a need for more and more equity-oriented health impact assessment for the restrictive measures of crisis management, of using the European fund, linking more health equity and development. I think equity-oriented health impact assessment is not just science, semi-science, is not just knowledge, is one of the most important advocacy tools in our intersectorial discussion in favor of health equity. just making transparent the impact of policy in the field of health for the decision-making system. We have to learn that the world does not turn around health people. We think that the others have to understand our priorities, they have to join our... No, we have to understand the priorities of other areas. Social policy, even policy of finance, and somehow to try to integrate our techniques and our values in their system and put high health on the agenda of other sectors. This requires a quite different way of thinking, meaning that just come with us and we will change the health of the nation. It does not work simply. Also, that's why we have to utilize, to learn to utilize, and to work to not utilizing this very instrumental, to really to work together with the programs for poverty and social exclusion. Also, it's important in this overall crisis management situation to make health as indicator of overall development for the whole of the political decision-making system. Although we need, of course, and we have the pleasure to discuss about it a lot, an improved management of care, improving the accessibility for different socially excluded groups. And even if there is a debate in health policy literature on the value of this example good practice type approach, whether they are useful or not, whether they are model or not, and so on. However, we need really some success stories. And what is success in improving health of the socially excluded is also a very tough issue to conceptualize. What's effectiveness, what's success, and so on and so on. But we need indeed examples of good practice. So, what about our own job? We have to collect evidence on the effect of the economic crisis, on social and economic determinants on health, and on health equity, and to demonstrate it to our government. We have to develop HIC and MOOC now, tailor-made health programs for the victims of the crisis. We have to develop research and argumentation on the relationship, economy, health investment, including the questions whether we like it or not, effectiveness and efficiency. I know this is a very slippery question, but if we can't use the economic threshold, we will lose the negotiating process. Although we have to analyze the new economic, social, and political circumstances emerging from the crisis management and to rethink public health strategies accordingly. And last but not least, and this is also difficult, to reinvent our language of advocacy in the new situation. Because we can use our traditional language and we already know the result. Last decade. So, if they don't change, we have to change. So, I think here I can stop and thank you for your attention.
I think it would, there's time I'll do for them to just ask a couple of questions if people have that in mind. Peter?
Yes?
The question here.
Thank you for starting on LSE. Although, I mean, we will need at least another year before we can get any meaningful data to give us any impact on the current crisis in Western Europe. I don't know whether I see it as bleak as you see it in terms of victims of the crisis. I mean, the evidence actually so far is pretty controversial. So, I mean, it might actually be that unemployment might not be so bad because people have got more free time to exercise. I mean, obviously, we are not going to have enough information on mental health, but I wouldn't see, I mean, I agree with you that there is a need to monitor, but maybe not as negative, because so far we haven't got really a straight answer on whether it's going to be as bad as predicted. The other thing, the other thing I was wondering about what you said about health being a development indicator, because I mean it currently is, even if we just consider the human.
In the Lisbon strategy there is one indicator on health, but in our national strategy planning, health is not an indicator of overall development, it's just a short remark. This is a political question. Concerning the short-term impact of the crisis on health, I would like to be serious. Of course, the crisis, the real crisis started last October, let's say. So, it no way to have short-term results, except on unemployment, we have the data. We have a formal knowledge on the impact of different types of unemployment. We know the impact of increasing unemployment. And we have hundreds of thousands of new unemployed. This is a fact. Not an epidemiological one, but a fact. And then we have evidence-based assumptions, if you like. What can be the impact on mental health, on workers, and I could continue, of the situation to be unemployed. But we have already statistics on increased, I have to repeat, domestic violence, which is not properly health, but is an indicator of something, of increasing aggressivity, increasing alcohol sales in Hungary, which is a good news for the budget, and maybe less good news for us. But I think we have sufficient scientific knowledge to forecast. We don't know the impact of the crisis, neither the length of the crisis, but we know is enough to see the danger and the risk, and to start to fight, and not to wait the epidemiological evidence.
Just one more question.
Can you comment a bit about the healthcare reforms in Hungary so far, or not? In the sense of, if there is one country which did put healthcare reform quite high in the agenda in the past, it has been Hungary.
In a half a minute, it's a total pitfall, it's stub, and this crisis time is totally unfavorable to this stuff. Yeah. Because the healthcare reform was stubbed last year. And I think the present government will partially lose the elections next year because of the healthcare reform. It's another question whether I personally am defending that healthcare reform. But one more comment. The declared top value for the healthcare reform in Hungary was equity in health, but translated more in terms of equity of access of the healthcare system.
Sounds better that healthcare reforms in Hungary have been overtaken by events, just like welfare reform in the UK. Dare I say, nobody's quite sizing up to it yet. If you can, I'd like to move on to hear Tom Pennell of the Department of Health in the UK, who's talking about primary care trust. Tom,
would you?
And thank you, Peter.
Right. I'm Tom Hennell. I'm the regional analyst from the Government Office for the North West. I am also a fairly long-term member, with a number of other people in this room and other people that you know, of the Technical Advisory Group on Resource Allocation. But I should say immediately that what I say is mine, not the views of the Technical Advisory Group, or the views of the Department of Health. Primary care trusts have a population of around about 300,000, and they are purchaser organisations. So we need to share to those purchaser organisations an appropriate sum of money. And the question is, how do we do it? And should there be within them that sum an allocation specifically to reduce health inequalities? In the allocation methodology that's been applied, For the past 5 or 6 years, there has been such an element, and the question we might ask is that extra element justified? It makes quite a big difference in terms of the amount of money that's moved around. Is such an extra sum in terms of health inequalities justified? And if an extra sum is justified, should it be going to primary care trusts, or should it be going to other organisations altogether? And I'm doing this in terms of the question about how we become ill. We are allocating policies on a principle of fair shares. The conventional method, before we were talking about allocating the health inequalities, was to use a modelled approach of express demand, that is, current service utilisation, modelling population numbers, age cost variation, additional needs, and projecting a target resource need that is a representative fair share, setting this against a historically rolled over resource allocation budget, and having some form of distance from target adjustment, which is applied to the extra, rather than picking up your point about when you haven't got much more growth to play with, it's much more difficult to change. That makes a number of presumptions. A presumption that those who don't present as ill can be considered as well. That's about a rather an odd presumption from the perspective of, for instance, pastoral theology or social philosophy, but it's a very common presumption when we start talking with clinicians. A presumption that the construction of illness does not vary systematically between user populations. Here I'm taking it as axiomatic that illness is a social construct. You're not ill because a doctor says you're ill, unless you are unfortunate enough to be in prison or the army or the man. But basically, you use the information, and other people use that information from a clinician, and those who are ill are those who are treated as ill. But what happens if some populations construct illness differently? And what happens if that different construction has itself a strong social pattern and social distinction? There I link back to something that we often say. Again, a health service, not an illness service. I think our minister said this not so long back, about a couple of months ago, to the Commonwealth Fund of New York, but it is something we always say. Again, a common feature in social philosophy and pastoral theology defines well-being as something distinct from not becoming ill. So, perhaps we ought to be looking at something that is different in terms of the classifying simply into the well, not ill, and the unwell, ill, which implies an analysis something like that. That's a simplification, a gross simplification. Illness and wellness are not simply by two-part variables, but for the purpose of analysis, for the purpose of demonstration, I'm simply going to treat it like that. This is a standard understanding in social philosophy, but can we actually apply that to a health data set and see whether it makes a difference? And here I'm going to jump over the technicalities and say, let's assume I have, and see what happens when we do. We've had, if we look at the Health Survey for England, this has 14,000 adults roughly in a structured sample. It also has children as well, but there are questions asked if children are different, and so we can't actually use those. We picked up about 2,000 items for each respondent. And among the questions it asks are the standard general health question, also a separate question on whether you have long-term illness and whether that illness is limiting or non-limiting in terms of your activities of daily life. And it's also, as part of that, asks selected questions on past doctor diagnoses. For our purposes, illness is here seen in our four-part analysis. Illness is here defined as having a limiting long-term illness. Question. If respondents report being diagnosed with a particular medical condition, how many of them are ill with that condition? How many of them report being ill with that condition? And is that reporting socially accurate? To go back. This is looking at high blood pressure. Roughly a quarter of adults reported having been diagnosed with high blood pressure by a doctor. And as you can see, it differs between in our four categories, the well ill, not well ill, unwell, not ill. What interests me is the blobs, which are against the right-hand side, as a strong difference in the propensity of different populations to report whether they have hypertension as a long-term illness, whether a limiting long-term illness or a non-limiting long-term illness. And those differences are significant, or most of them are significant, as you can see. We took another one. Actually, it's the only other one that we got sufficient numbers in to generate a good piece of work. This is looking at diabetes. Much lower prevalence of diabetes. Only about 5% report a doctor diagnosis of diabetes. Typically, 83-84% of those who report a doctor diabetes, doctor diagnosis, have also report the illness or a diabetic illness. But among the unwell, not ill, it drops to 68%. Again, that difference seems to be significant. So we've got an issue. It looks like we are having a differential construction on two common causes of premature mortality and preventable morbidity. It does look as if we're seeing significant differences when we apply that four-part analysis of the population. Becoming ill is different from becoming ill we've extracted from our long-term illness. Now we get onto the term technology. What do I mean by being well? There isn't a simple question on being well. There might be. There is proposed, I don't know whether you're familiar with the WemWeb's well-being survey instrument, but that is one that is being trialled and we're going to look at it within the Northwest region. I didn't have it. So I use categorical principal component analysis. I feed the Fed in 46 input characteristics and extracted two, and then rotated it to align with aging, and then the dimension, the cross-dimension that is not aging, I took as being well. So that's how I defined it. And that generated that analysis. The being well on the vertical axis and long-term illness on the horizontal axis. I took limiting long-term illness as my definition of illness, so that's one side of the four-part analysis, and then simply the lowest quintile on my wellness analysis to generate the other. Cross analysis, well, not ill, well, ill, unwell, not ill, like that. So that's how I got my particular approach, but potentially there might be a number of other ways of doing it. It is a simplified approach used for demonstration. What you should notice is that in practice we would expect, given the skew on the wellness, on the illness boundary, that those who are well not ill will be differentially likely to be more well than those who are well ill, and equally those who are unwell not ill ought to be differentially more well than those who are unwell ill, if you can see the analysis. Simply because that and that one is longer than that one, and vice versa. So we get that proportion of the population, 64%, 16%, 10%, 10%. When we try and apply this sort of analysis back to resource allocation, we pick out two common concerns that are expressed about resource allocation. The first has not been mentioned today, but it's not surprised me. If we'd been talking 20 years ago, it would have probably been the first thing that people would mention, the inverse care law. Proposition that the more affluent you are, the better able you are to take advantage of health resources and health facilities. This relates to express demand. The second one, which we have talked about, is unmet need. It's a different proposition that less affluent populations are in some way faced systematically greater inhibitions, perhaps from resource constraints, perhaps from cultural constraints, against being able to present with illness. A slightly different analysis here from that which Sarah Allen had, but broadly speaking, I'm assuming that the category of well-ill, the top right-hand of my four boxes, is a systematic expression or a re-expression of the inverse care law, which in its origin is probably more of a polemical construct than an actual analytical tool. And equally, the category unwell, not ill, is a systematic expression of unmet need. So when we look at resource allocation, we're saying, can we do something to alleviate health inequalities? If we are able to do something, can we give resources to primary care trusts to do it? Will primary care trusts' purchasing activities be actually a tool for doing that? And thirdly, then, and how much money should they get? And thirdly, if we were to do that, if we were to get rid of the effects of the health inequalities in terms of unmet need and the inverse care law, how would the fair shares differ from that which would apply if we're simply working on express demand? In order to do that, we say, if we were to look, picking up the phenomenon that you've just observed, assuming, which is a big and heroic assumption, that this is a general pattern, I could only actually test two items in the health survey, but if it was in fact a general situation, then if health resources are only guided by express demand, then we can say, and we add extra resources to the system, the benefits of those extra resources will tend to come more differentially to the well-ill, while premature mortality and preventable morbidity will tend to concentrate in the unwell, not ill. If we're looking at this a bit more rigorously, one point needs to be brought out. There are strong age differences in between our four categories. There is no age patterning, because that's how we've defined it, on the barrier between wellness and unwellness, but illness increases substantially with age. So if we are looking at our analysis, we need to adjust for illness. And I've done that using logistic regression. I've also adjusted not just for age, but for gender and for general health. And when we do that, the difference is because the pattern that we observed for hypertensive illness, that actually gets a little less, and only this difference remains as significant. The difference between the unwell ill and the well ill is the only one that remains as significant. Paradoxically, when I do the same for diabetes, adjusted for age, gender and general health, the differences become much bigger. The odds ratios for the unwell ill are now a third as likely to report themselves as being having a diabetic illness as are the well, not ill, or any of the other categories. One or two other characteristics, I'll just flip through these. The unwell, not ill are much more likely to smoke, adjusted for age and sex. They're much less likely to eat healthily. Interesting patterns in terms of obesity. I'm not going to go through and describe these. Interesting patterns in terms of binge drinking. Less likely than the well ill, well not ill to binge drink. But also differences in terms of social capital. Strong differences in terms of not joining local organisations. Interesting to notice that the well-ill are more likely to join social organisations even than the well-not-ill, though it's probably not significant. What the well-ill are certainly likely to join are religious groups. Marx regarded religion as the opiate of the people. Actually, it looks as if religion is more a stimulus to social activity and is differentially healthy. The unwell not ill are much more likely to be lone parents. They're much less likely to engage in recreational exercise. Indeed, notice that the well ill have quite a high rate of recreational exercise. And they are highly likely to distrust their neighbours. And they are the most likely to be worried about local crime, if I haven't got it. What that suggests, possibly, is that we're not just looking at health. Clearly, our vertical axis is a wellness axis. Our horizontal axis is a health-specific axis, illness. But it may well be that the same vertical axis applies in different social domains with different horizontal axes in terms of being well against education, being well against having a job, being well against having good housing. And then finally, the technical bit. I've left this to the last because in principle it doesn't actually matter how I did it. At least I hope it doesn't matter. But this is how I did it. And you may find it interesting. What I did was I took these 46 variables. They're incidentally selected because they did come out to be in a series of models as being significantly associated with the general health variable. And then I've just shown selection there. We can see we output a pattern and we then rotate it using a Varimax rotation and using the most common, the highest commonality variables within our distribution, we get these, that vertical and horizontal axis. The horizontal axis is clearly age. We can see the age distribution. The vertical axis is strongly related to income, but also to the GHQ score and one or two other things. Economic status actually aligns along both axes, which is nice. If we add everything in, and I can't add everything in at once, I have to do it twice, we get two further axes. This is the axis, there's a physical activity axis which runs through all of our physical illness, and at right angles to that, a confidence and resilience axis which relates to mental illness. A radical difference in patterning between physical illnesses and mental illnesses. And we can see also on our mental illness alliance, we've got a whole lot of aligned with that, things like people try to be helpful, religious organisations and so on. And if we look at the rest, we can see very many more social capital variables align along this axis, whereas it's physical activity variables that arise along that axis, which generates some interesting results. It may well be that you can ditch my four-part analysis and keep this, or conversely, keep my four-part analysis and ditch this, depending on your preference. What I do find, and Dr. O'Donnell may find this interesting, is that when we look at the age profile, we find, as he found, that the widest differences in age profile are in early middle age. These are individual quintiles of deprivation using the deprivation score of the local area. The widest variations are in the 45 to 54 age group, whereas they narrow significantly over 65 and over 75.
Which deprivation index is that?
That's the index of multiple deprivation 2004. Yes, 2004. That's the one on the data set.
And you took the health component out of that, I assume?
No, we just used the... That's recorded on the health survey for England, which area they're in. We can't take the health survey out of it because it is simply recorded as an area descriptor. And that's it.
Thank you. Would people like to raise any questions?
Sorry, do you make the link? So how do you actually use this to attribute funds?
Well, at the moment, we can't. The question of how we use it to attribute funds is a secondary question. What it does do is it probably demonstrates if the methodology is justified. It says that we do have to do something about inequalities, and it probably ought to be something that would be directed through health services, though it might be directed in other ways as well. What it suggests, broadly speaking, in terms of our... what it does suggest is that if we look on the scatter plot, is that the axis of confidence and resilience, that is, those factors that are associated with the social capital of confidence and resilience, is closer to our well-being axis than it is to the physical illness axis. Whereas the physical illness axis is closer to aging. What that suggests is that possibly when we're looking at the dimensions and the structure of what leads to wellness, we should be looking at these factors, at social capital, at social resilience, and at social confidence, rather than perhaps at looking at differential rates of certainly physical illness. Though we ought perhaps to be looking at mental illness. These are the sorts of analysis. But as I say, broadly speaking, it suggests that we haven't made a catastrophic mistake, which is nice, in putting in an extra degree of money for health inequalities. What it doesn't say is whether the extra degree of money we put in for health inequalities is justified in terms of the sum.
Question at the back?
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure that I follow everything you're doing, but from what it appears to me is you're using the principal components analysis, and so a number of dimensions are put into the principal components, like income, etc., and then you're using that to try and identify a component which you are labelling as wellness.
We're reducing the 46 to 2.
Yeah. Okay.
And the 46 summarises the 2 summarise the 46, but summarise it to a different degree. What isn't included in there, in fact, is our diagnostic components. They weren't part of the 46 input there.
The problem one has when one uses principal components in that way is that you put a particular label on the on the principal component which you find, but perhaps we might think of other labels to put on that component. So if we suggest a more simplistic way perhaps to go about this, and you can tell me why your method is better than my simplistic approach. In the Health Survey of England, you have, if we just take blood pressure, you have measured blood pressure, and you have reported blood pressure.
Yes.
So from that, you can identify people who have a diagnosis of blood pressure, and you can see whether they report or not. So you can identify your four groups from those comparisons, and then you could look at your well-ill group, etc., in relation to the factors which you're using in the principal components analysis. So you can see that the people that have a diagnosis or would be diagnosed according to their measured blood pressure but do not report, you can look to see to what extent that is correlated with income, it's correlated with the social capital, etc., etc.
Yeah. There is indeed a measurement. One of the difficulties is that that's not applied to the entire sample, or you have to volunteer for that bit. and the volunteering is differentially skewed, which is a tricky bit. What is also the case is that, of course, people are reporting their illness first, so they haven't received the diagnosis from the nurse who does the survey at the time they report their illness. So, I mean, there's a problem of sequence. The nurse visits them to take their blood pressure after they've reported whether they've had an illness. And it isn't easy to cross-reference there between illness. What we can do is check whether from the nurse-reported blood pressure the degree of accuracy in reporting previous doctor diagnosis, which is, I think, fairly high. But Peter may be able to correct me on that one.
So, I mean, I think I recall that Carol Proper and Mike Shields have done some analysis style which I describe, and so it's the second problem which you mentioned perhaps is not completely an obstacle.
Yeah,
but they were able to, I mean, as far as I can recall, they showed, for example, differentials by income in the extent to which people report having high blood pressure when they either have high blood pressure or not.
Yes. We certainly, we can look, using this analysis, we can look at the people who reported a diagnosis and choose not to report an illness, and we can look at their social patterning and have one say.
Could you just comment on one thing to the uninitiated? I'm very familiar with the limiting, non-limiting illness.
Yes.
And I've often felt that a lot of our discussions depend on the crudity of the results.
Yes.
And in some senses, you're comparing the subjective and objective, but you made no remark about how we can improve the measurement of severity of illness. I mean, these are almost binary hypotheses. That you're taking, and would you want to distinguish what you've just been saying about the primary component analysis from the grading of severity in terms either of objective measurement of some kind or of the subjective answer to a number of questions? Because I found in the past that a lot of key areas in examining health, that if you take the trouble of having sufficient detail about both the objective and the subjective, that the two come together much more closely in terms of the overall ranking of severity.
The only information that we have on the health survey that we can use is by cross-referencing it to the general health question. Which is a little bit tricky to do because the proportion of the population who report not good health is actually lower than the proportion who report a long-term illness. It would be nicer if the general health question was had a more graded response. But we have used, I mean, as I say, in a number, when I sort of looked at the significance of the differences, as working in the logistic regression, not only did I allow for age and gender, I also built in the differential response due to the different categories on the general health question, which, as I say, did make a difference for the result.
Yes, so your answer is really that you're having to make do with what you've got, rather than sort of having an appendage of an argument for kind of follow-up or pilot, more intensive survey to direct to multiply better indicators of measurement.
Yes.
Okay. Then we come to number three, and I'm pleased to introduce, when I find the page, Marielle, Dr. Marielle Jules, of the National Institute for Public Health and the Environment in the Netherlands. Marielle.
afternoon, everybody. I'm honored to be participating in this LSE seminar, and I am glad to be able to share with you the Dutch development in policies to tackle health inequalities. I will briefly touch upon the magnitude of health inequalities in the Netherlands, so what are we talking about if we discuss, if we want to tackle health inequality, the history of Dutch policy, as well as the recent policy plan, our first policy plan to tackle health inequalities in the Netherlands, which has been published in December last year. I'm very proud to be able to present to you our first nationally representative data on educational differences in life expectancy as well as healthy life expectancy, which have been calculated by our Central Bureau of Statistics last autumn after some years of elaborate discussion and talking about the methodology to use, as well as, more important, what data to use, since we do not have registries on socioeconomic measures in the Netherlands. And we also do not have the census, as I just told Martin. So we rely on the link of the basic administrative data with health survey data, as well as the mortality registry. And it turned out that the gap in life expectancy for women was about 6 years, and for men in the higher educated groups compared with the lower educated group was 7 years. And the healthy life expectancy differences are 16 for women and 19 years for men. So the health inequalities in the Netherlands are rather substantial. And in the 90s, after some broad concern on health inequality, we vigorously started on developing our knowledge and on the magnitude of health inequalities in the Netherlands with a research program focusing on setting up a longitudinal survey to find out what kind of health outcomes socioeconomic inequalities exist. And so in the end, after having described the magnitude of the inequalities, the Ministry of Health decided to pursue socioeconomic health inequalities as one of their goals, and also decided to install a second research program which was focused more on not only describing the health inequalities and the development of the inequalities in the Netherlands, but also focusing on what to do. So based on systematic research of and evaluating interventions, and coming up with recommendations on how to tackle these health inequalities. And this report of the Alberta Committee was published in 2001 and welcomed by the that time the government. And as in a reaction, they also adopted a quantitative target with the intent to reduce the health inequalities, or specifically the inequalities in healthy life expectancy, with a quarter of the magnitude of that moment, which was an estimation or a wild guess. I just told you, we only last year were able to calculate nationally representative data, but at that time we estimated the difference between the lower and higher educated groups to be 12 years, so the government decided that they committed themselves to raise the life expectancy of the lower educated group with 3 years in the period up till 2020. After that, we had a change of government. We turned to a more right-wing government, and nothing really happened. So the government committed themselves to this target, and that was it. The target existed, and no subsequent action was taken. Despite of comments of the Dutch Court of Audit, as well as the Dutch Inspector of Healthcare, who summoned the minister to take action in case to reach the target in 2020. Finally, after a couple of years, the Minister of Health reacted with delegating the responsibility to tackle health inequalities towards the 30 large cities in the Netherlands as part of the urban policy program. And in the end, the cities decided to tackle health inequalities focusing on overweight among youngsters. So you tell me if that's going to help, or if we'll be able to manage to reduce the health inequalities in life expectancy in that sense. In 2007, we had again a change of government, so we're now having a more central left wing government. And not surprisingly, as these things happen, health inequalities are back on the agenda, and our Minister of Health is talking again about health inequalities, and the government is focusing towards a more equal distribution of health. They even reflected on the target of 2001. In December last year, the Department of Health came up with a new policy plan for dealing with health inequalities. It is called Towards an Able-Bodied Society. And the main principle is that they adhere to the principle of own responsibility, individual responsibility. So to enable people to make the healthy choice, but by no way wanting to force them or having only showing the, or at least in implying that they want to force them. So it's all about own an individual responsibility, and the government enables people to be policy plan for dealing with health inequalities, they focus on the lower socioeconomic groups as well as on ethnic minorities and inhabitants of deprived neighborhoods, which I will touch upon later in more detail. This policy plan lacks a quantitative target. So although the cabinet and the government in 2007 did adhere or at least reinforce the target which was adopted in 2001. At this point, in December 2008, they said we don't want to adopt any new target yet in view of this new figures we just have been seeing. Calculated by the Central Bureau of Statistics. We first need to reflect on that. We also want to adopt realistic targets, and so we have to recalculate, taking into consideration the interventions possible, the policies we will put into place to reach these targets, and this overall advice from all of the other integrated policy actors, taking into consideration, we will come up with a quantitative target. At the time they published this this policy plan, they were still confident that they will come up with a target. I'm not so sure anymore, I have to admit. Seeing what is happening, and basically that's not much. There has not been any development in talking or discussing this target, let alone calculating or doing some impact assessments. And on the other hand, realistic targets do depend on political commitment. And if there's no political commitment and there's no financial budget, there no targets can be realized. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg discussion. And I really wonder where we will end up. The main mechanisms which are portrayed in this policy plan are the necessity of having integrated policy, so not only the policy of the Ministry of Health is taking into account, but the bigger picture is this picture. And the will and the use of prevention combined with cure, especially primary health care, and a decentralized implementation of the policy plan. I will start explaining these three mechanisms. The policy plan describes the measures which are in place in the Netherlands and have been implemented by other ministries, which are presumed to have a positive impact on health inequalities, at least on immigrant or equality as such. But these are all measures which are already in place, and nothing new is proposed, and nothing new will be implemented. And there's also no effort taken to really integrate these policies. They have made a nice list of potentially positive policies from other ministries. They also present a list of measures of the Minister of Health, which are already being undertaken. So this is the first part is this inclusion of prevention in the standard health insurance. This covers, for example, smoking cessation advices, as well as the promotion of physical activity or self-management of chronic illness. And it's based on the idea that the GP is seeing most of the population each year in the Netherlands, especially the lower educated groups, and that they advise on the healthy lifestyle from the GP is proving to be really effective in this sense. So that this all this Ministry of Health policies do mainly focus on the lifestyle. The policy plan is taking as a preventive as possible focus. They adhere to ensure a good start for everybody, focusing on education, on social welfare, on employment opportunities for everybody to have a good start into adult life. But they acknowledge that it's not possible for everybody to start adult life in such a sense. So they, for the people who are still categorized as deprived in sense of being unemployed or having a lower educational level, they also try to reduce the health effect of these unfavorable socioeconomic circumstances by generic policies focusing on living environments, on planning, on housing, etc. As decentralized as possible, the government focuses on what other social parties can do, and specifically more local social parties can do to improve the health, and especially the health of the lower socioeconomic groups. And therefore they have asked several national councils to advise them on what can be the role and the activities and the interventions of particularly schools, municipalities, and employers, to improve the health of the people they are involved with. And these advices will be presented to the government within a few months, before or during summer. And the government has at least postponed also the discussion on this target until they have learned what the schools and what the municipalities and local government and what employers decide, or at least envision what they can do to reduce health inequalities. As I said, this policy plan also focuses particularly on deprived neighborhoods as well as ethnic minorities. And as far as the inhabitants of the deprived neighborhoods concerns, the policy plan links up with the deprived districts approach, which has been launched by the Minister of Housing and Communities and Integration in 2008, in July. And the minister selected 40 deprived neighborhoods with massive problems in the fields mentioned here. Health was not an issue in this selection process. We, from the National Institute, did look at the at least self-reported health indicators in these neighborhoods. And not surprisingly, it turns out that, of course, in those neighborhoods, the health is relatively poor compared to the average of the deaf population. And, to make up for the fact that health at first was not an issue but seems to be a problem, and as part of this new policy plan, there have been planned healthy neighborhood experiments which will focus and which will implement interventions in the field of focusing on residents' living conditions as well as primary care together, so an integrated approach. And this approach is also evaluated, and it's part of this Urban 40 project in which I'm also personally involved, where we are going to study the developments of the health of the people living in this deprived neighborhoods and try to relate it to the interventions that have been taken and in a way develop an evidence base for integrated interventions to improve the health of lower or socioeconomic groups or deprived communities. So in the future we might know more. And another specific aspect which has been touched upon in the plan are these ethnic minorities. And this is actually the one and only a group for which the policy plan promises to implement new interventions and new activities. So it's not only writing down what is already being done, but it's also promising new interventions, mainly focusing on the quality of care. Accessibility does not seem to be too much of a problem in the Netherlands, but we have there's some evidence, and we do think that there is a problem with the quality of care for ethnic minorities in the Netherlands. And there's also going to be more research and finding out more of the data. But at the same time, we're also already in developing interventions to improve the quality of care for these migrants. To summarize, what is happening and what is the content of this policy plan? Well, health inequalities are back on the agenda. We're talking again about health inequalities. Our minister knows what health inequalities are. We are still a bit hesitating about how to handle it and what to do. Well, of course, what to do about it. Everybody is struggling with that part. So we are very much searching for how to proceed and what's the process. What's the process to evolve? So now we have this commitment. Now we have a spark of a commitment, and how can we develop that commitment? And what is the process we need to embark on to find out what will we need to do? In this policy plan, it's a good start. There's, of course, also still room for improvement, since we still do lack this target. And, I would be very curious what I would be presenting if you invite me again next year. And there's also this integrated policy is one of the realms the policy plan adheres to, but it's not yet been implemented, or it's just a list of things what is happening, and they do acknowledge the social determinants, but they do not really integrate it into one policy and into one coordinated effort to really tackle this health inequalities, which are present in the Netherlands. And also, there are not yet any new measures or any new interventions that are promised to be implemented. And as we see it now with the changing financial and economical climate, is this enough, this list of policies already present, when it's not an integrated policy, and there's no additional effort and no additional budget? Will this work? So, thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
In order to give our last speaker a comfortable time, I would have to just ask you for one or two questions, if you have, for Marielle. People have been... No, go ahead.
Would it be fair to say that it's an ambitious policy and that's it?
In a sense that it's...
That doesn't seem to be much fair. It seems to say that we finally got a policy, but there doesn't seem to be much substance to it.
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
So, but you're optimistic. You sound optimistic. Are you optimistic?
Yes, I am. It's... just being me, I have to admit. But also the fact that at least for the first time in Dutch history now we have a policy plan. It's back on the agenda and there is the intention, it shows the intention to do something about it. And we'll have to keep on provoking our colleagues from the Ministry of Health in really doing so. And I think it's one of the tasks for us and being one of the researchers closely connected with our policymakers to make sure that they are making progress.
You've got two more.
In addition, I think the decentralized approach could be very promising. You should not forget that many of the, let's say, risk groups live in the big cities, in these 40 areas, and in many of these big cities, they because of the city councils, the minority themselves are very well represented. So, I mean that's maybe something which could work in its favor. It's a decentralized approach. They have their own budgets. They're having their own decisions on what to concentrate. And that could...
Also, the integrated approach seems to be easier implemented on the local level.
They're not dependent on the Hague for the money.
Yeah, for money.
So, I said one, we have two, there's a third here. Do you want to go in now?
No, I was just wondering, what is the barrier to getting a budget? How can you present a plan not backed by a budget? Why is this accepted by the public? I mean, how can you stand up as a minister, say, I'll do this, and have no money?
Yeah, because he also didn't introduce any new plan. So he said, I'm already doing this.
Ah, okay.
So then you don't need an additional budget.
It's the Dutch way.
I apologize for shooting.